a trusted voice of truth and light.
God gave me a gift. I shovel well. I shovel very well.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
We've got a blind date with destiny.
And it looks like she's ordered the lobster.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Well, hello there and welcome to the show. Hey, if you're a first-time wrong thinker or a long-time wrong thinker, you are welcome here as we gather to challenge the narrative, to think a little more deeply and a little more clearly about things, and at the end of the day, to come away from whatever is being discussed as more sure of what we stand for than simply who or what we're against. I know it's kind of a tall order, and it's not always easy because there's a lot of controversy on any given day, but it's worth it because the ultimate goal here is we're standing up for things that matter, things like personal conscience, things like freedom, things like private property rights, freedom of association, etc. That's stuff that matters. It's stuff that makes life better. Our program is brought to you by great sponsors like MonticelloCollege.org, also LifesavingFood.com, the Heather Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage, and we're pleased to welcome a new sponsor to the show, GovernYourIncome.com. Now, there's a link that you can use to follow each one of these sponsors or to visit their websites, learn more about them. You'll find it in my show notes at TheBrianHydeShow.com. So I want to start with an acknowledgement that everything becomes politicized turns into a power struggle. And this is one of the reasons why I personally have backed way off of politics. I may talk about some political issues from time to time, but if you pay attention, if you notice, I'm usually not stumping for, well, you know, it's rah, rah, red and boo to the blue. It's so easy to get caught up in that tribal mentality where the bumper sticker slogans are really the primary way of communicating whatever it is we believe. I think a great example of what this looks like is the current war over school books and school curriculum. Parents versus school boards. You know, we're getting the Department of Justice involved, for crying out loud, because these parents may actually end up being some kind of domestic terrorist for challenging the people in charge of deciding what their kids are supposed to learn. All right, this is where we need a good voice of reason. And that's where I turn to someone like Jacob Hornberger, president and founder of the Future of Freedom Foundation. By the way, I subscribe to their daily emails, and they come through 6 days a week. If you go to fff.org, you'll get probably close to a dozen articles every day, or Monday through Saturday, that they send out right to your email box. You don't have to read every single article, but I promise you, you will find things that will give you a much better take on what's happening in the world around you, and coming from a very principled, liberty-centered point of view, as opposed to Democrats, Republicans, etc. So in speaking of the current, you know, back and forth, the tug of war taking place over students in public schools, Jacob Hornberger refers to it as the statist war over public school books. And that may rub you the wrong way, but I want you to hear him out, or at least consider what he has to say. Is it possible that we're missing the point when we focus on just strictly that binary look? It's either this or it's this. What if all that fighting back and forth is keeping us from seeing the real challenge or the real root of the problem? Hornberger says statists all over the country are going to war with each other over which books will be permitted to be placed in public, meaning government, school libraries. And he says their mindsets are so mired in statism that they cannot see there's no possible way to resolve their war in a way that will make everyone happy. Now, what they fail to recognize is that their basic paradigm for education, that the state should be educating children, is the real problem. And as long as the state is in charge of education, there will always be fierce political battles over which textbooks will be used, which books should be in the library, what should be taught in the classroom. Moreover, he says the majority will rule. Now, it might be a majority of school board members at the local level making the decisions, or it might be a majority in the state legislature, or a majority at the state board of education. All these people, of course, are either elected or appointed through the political process. And whatever side is in the majority, well, they'll be happy that their book selections have prevailed. And whoever's in the minority will be unhappy and will cry censorship. And the political battles will continue with each side fighting hard to get their people elected or appointed into public office. Now, I'm going to hit pause here for just a second and just ask you, does that not make sense, at least on some level? Because it's really an either-or thing. Well, you know, we either win this school board election or we win this discussion over this issue or we don't. So it really comes down to who gets to do what to whom. But that's the nature of politics. And again, this is one of the reasons why I have chosen to step back from politics in so many areas. Because it needlessly pits us against each other because it's more about what we do to one another than actually working with each other. Now, Jacob Hornberger from here talks about religious liberty, and he starts by saying, thank goodness for the First and 14th Amendments. These two amendments prohibit states from involving themselves in religious affairs. And he says, imagine if we didn't have those two express prohibitions. We would be experiencing the same types of fierce political wars in religion that we're experiencing in education. There would also be battles over what religious books to promote or display in churches. There'd be fights over which version of the Bible to use. People would be battling over which religious doctrines to adopt. There would be forever wars over the format for Sunday services. There would be compulsory church attendance laws for children, as well as church buses to transport them to church. And there would undoubtedly be battles over whether to adopt a system of church vouchers or charter churches. There would be locally elected religious boards, similar to school boards. There would be a state board of religion. There would be a fiercely fought political race with candidates' religions being an important factor in the electoral campaigns. But he says none of those religious battles exist for one reason, and that is because the states are prohibited from involving themselves in religion. Instead, there's a multiplicity of churches and religions from which people can choose. So if they don't like what's happening or if they don't like what's being taught in one church or religion, they can move to another one. People are not able to impose their religious views on others through majority vote. I know some people may be shaking their heads going, come on, that's such a poor comparison. It's apples to oranges. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but that seems to hold up pretty well with me. The solution that Hornberger is getting at, if you haven't figured it out already, is he's talking about the need to separate school and state. Right? Most people are on board when we separate church and state and it avoids conflict. I think the same would be true if we separate school and state. Hornberger says that's the only permanent solution to the book controversy in public schools. Rather than engage in nasty political wars over which books to include in the school library, over which doctrines are going to be taught in the classroom, or which textbooks are going to be used, just separate school and state, just as our ancestors separated church and state. Jacob Hornberger says with a free market educational system, it would be like it is in religion, meaning people would be free to select the school or educational vehicle of their choice. And if they don't like how a school is operating or what it's teaching or what books it's using, they're free to simply move to a different school, one that better reflects their values. So he says Americans have two choices. Number one, maintain the status quo, the statist status quo, and engage in endless political battles in education. Or number two, separate school and state and bring peace, harmony, and education to society. Now, I promise you, there's someone within the sound of my voice right now looking at the speaker and going, hey, you make it sound like it's so simple. And I'll get you. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. But I think in this case, it probably is that simple. The bigger question now is, how do you find enough people willing to separate school and state? Because you want to talk about an entrenched bureaucracy. Holy cow. The education lobby, that is a group that votes as a block, generally. This is not to, you know, besmirch those fine teachers and educators out there, but generally between the teachers' unions, politicians, and, you know, state education apparatus, There's a pretty united front for keeping this all in the hands of the state. Immense amounts of money flow through their hands and into their pockets, and some of it makes its way to the actual classroom or to the actual students or the actual educators. But mostly it's about power. And as we're seeing, some will use that power to teach your kids things that are questionable at best, right? I mean, teaching your kids about certain perversions at the age of five. I don't know who thought that was necessary, but hey, you know, that's one of the things they insist they gotta know. Teaching them critical race theory, everything that came before us is wrong, everything is racist. Take the state out of the equation, nobody can force anybody to have to listen to a particular message.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. One of my great sponsors is lifesavingfood.com. I talk about food storage on a pretty regular basis, and it's not because I'm trying to prepare you for the coming apocalypse, but just simply because, look, even in good times, unexpected things can happen. Most of us know someone, or maybe we've personally experienced, you know, a temporary loss of employment, or maybe an illness that takes a bite out of the family budget, or unexpected car repairs. You know, the list is endless. There are a lot of things that can go wrong because we live in a world that, unfortunately, you know, where that's the norm. Things going wrong is really the norm. But if there's something you can do to solidify your position, like having some food on hand for a rainy day, particularly if it's something that you can stow away with confidence knowing that it has a 25-year shelf life, well, let's just face it, that's money well spent. You're going to eat the food eventually. The price you get it at today is most likely going to be better than the price you're going to get it at tomorrow. That's more true than ever with what's happening inflation-wise. So please take a little trip over to my webpage, thebrianhydeshow.com. You actually can find it in today's show notes. And give some love to my sponsors. Particularly, I'd like you to check out lifesavingfood.com. If you make the decision to purchase, just put in my last name, Hyde, H-Y-D-E, and you get a 20% discount at checkout. That's very generous, by the way. And that's a better discount than if you went to ReadyWise Foods themselves. So thanks in advance for helping to keep my sponsors afloat and letting them know their message reached your ears. Let's talk about how the medical establishment has been fighting so hard against things like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. And I don't understand this. I mean, I understand that there are differing points of view, but there's a dogmatic quality that seems to come out whenever you bring up things like ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine. And I don't know if this is because the medical establishment is just all in on, you know, nope. The only thing that's acceptable, the only thing that works is that we get everybody vaccinated. Everybody. And it's that, I don't know how to put it, that absolutism that everybody must do this, no one can resist. That's exactly what's pushing me into the corner of, no, I can't do this. My conscience won't let me do it because it's being forced on people at so many different levels. I mean, if you can make the case, this is good, this is efficacious, this is, you know, this is something that actually works. It's safe and effective. I know we hear those words a lot. But there are a lot of questions that remain. Just because some bureaucrat or some bureaucrat wearing a lab coat says, hey, this is safe and effective, does not automatically make it so, unless you believe in word magic. But, you know, I don't. And isn't it curious how hard the medical establishment has fought against alternative treatments to COVID, like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine? I got a great article here from Dr. Harold Pease. This is from libertyunderfire.org. And this is one of the happy stories. I guess this is one of the good news stories of the day. Ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine for COVID can be prescribed in Nebraska. I'm looking at a headline that's part of this article. Ivermectin could have saved millions of lives, but doctors were told not to use it. And before I dive into this article here, I've seen two charts in the last couple of weeks. One was for India. The most recent was just a couple of days ago for Japan. Both of these are countries which decided to not fight against ivermectin, for instance, but make it widely available to their populations. You should see how the case count has dropped in both countries. It's really remarkable. I mean, it's not just, oh, well, there's a little dip in the numbers. Well, no big deal. No, it's like a precipitous drop. Why don't we hear more about that? Why can't we stray from the narrative to look at some of these alternatives? I'm not suggesting this is for everybody. I'm not a doctor. But there are enough doctors out there who say, look, these drugs have been around for a long time. They clearly have a track record, as opposed to the vaccine, which is still new and relatively unknown as far as its long-term effects. Here's what Dr. Harold Pease has to say about it. He says, finally, a breakthrough in the war against ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine in the treatment of COVID-19, which, according to the proponents of these drugs, could have saved hundreds of thousands of American lives had they not been politicized by the FDA, the CDC, the World Health Organization, NIH, AMA, APHA, and ASHP. These strongly opposed the ordering, prescribing, and dispensing of these drugs to prevent or to treat COVID, despite their enormous success by physicians all over America and throughout the world. And of course, the largely controlled press, like robots, chimed in against. Now, Dr. Pease says, despite the weaponization of these drugs, the state of Nebraska supports doctors' freedom to prescribe them with informed consent of the patient. At the request of Danette Smith, the CEO of the Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services, Nebraska Attorney General Doug Peterson issued a legal opinion after a thorough review of the clinical studies of the two drugs before and after COVID, and concluded that the preponderance of scientific evidence favored their use in treating COVID for those who wish to use them. Now, in this review, Peterson cited numerous studies showing ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine reduced mortality by up to 75% or more when used as a preventative or prophylaxis for COVID, suggesting hundreds of thousands of lives could have been saved had the drugs been widely used in America. Both drugs have been successfully used long-term. Hydroxychloroquine discovered in 1949, ivermectin discovered in 1975, 3.7 billion doses administered since the 1980s, safely, and each for multiple afflictions and off-label usage. Now, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., chairman of the Children's Health Defense, spoke of Nebraska's bold attorney general's effort to reestablish medical freedom in his state, saying every citizen should be grateful for Doug Peterson's thoughtful and courageous counteroffensive against the efforts of Big Pharma, its captive federal regulators, and its media and social media allies to silence doctors and deny Americans life-saving treatments. Mary Holland, Children's Health Defense President, identified best the effect of the AG's decision. Let doctors get back to being doctors without being second-guessed by government or pharmacists or others interfering in the crucial doctor-patient relationship. Neither big government nor big pharma can tell doctors or patients what they can do or not do regarding their health. At least in a free society, that should be true. Now, the report summarized findings on these two drugs. Respecting a hydroxychloroquine study in 2004, they revealed that chloroquine is an effective inhibitor of the replication of the severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus, or SARS-CoV, in vitro, and should be considered for immediate use in the prevention and treatment of SARS-CoV infections. That's the virus causing the disease COVID-19. A study the following year showed it had strong antiviral effects on SARS-CoV infection and was effective in preventing the spread of SARS-CoV in cell cultures. More studies revealed that hydroxychloroquine significantly reduces the risk of hospitalization and death when administered to particularly high-risk outpatients as part of the early COVID-19 treatment. So what about ivermectin? Well, we're going to have to pump the brakes here because we're up against the spot break, but we'll talk about that next. And again, I'm referring to an article here from Dr. Harold Pease. He is not a medical doctor. He actually has a PhD in constitutional law, but the man has a take that is well worth considering. And I have a link in the show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com, just in case you're looking for a little interesting reading to fill your day later on.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
And we are back. Thanks again for being part of our growing audience of wrong thinkers. Again, this show is not to convince you who or what to be against, but rather to help you become more certain of who you are, what you stand for, and better still, what you can do about what's happening in the world around us. We have a lot more influence than we think. I'm sharing an article here from Dr. Harold Pease. This is from his website, libertyunderfire.org. And it's an article about ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine for COVID now being able to be prescribed in Nebraska. He talked about hydroxychloroquine and its proven track record for patients as part of an early COVID-19 treatment. Now let's talk about ivermectin. This is the one that really seems to get the brunt of the wrath of various people within the media and within the medical establishment. I mean, think about Joe Rogan, diagnosed with COVID here about a month and a half ago. He among the things he used were ivermectin, as well as a number of other treatments, and within a couple of days, he was right as rain. Something which really upsets the people who are primarily pushing fear of, oh, no, 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 no. And so CNN, among others, kept referring to, he took some kind of a medicine that normally is used as a horse dewormer, a veterinary medicine, something primarily used for horses, blah, blah, blah. Because in their narrative, in their consensus, that falls outside of the scope of acceptable, alternative treatments or just treatments generally for COVID. It wasn't supposed to work. And you're not supposed to think that there's anything that he could do besides take the jab. Well, they're not likely to give the mea culpa that they were wrong. But the fact is, ivermectin proved especially good at treating antiviral activity against several RNA viruses by blocking the nuclear trafficking of viral proteins. So just, by way of, armchair, virology here, COVID is a virus. And Dr. Harold Pease points out in the SARS epidemic of 2003, ivermectin demonstrated an ability to inhibit SARS-CoV-2 replication, like COVID, a respiratory infection leading to lower infection rates. Countries using ivermectin with routine mass drug administration of prophylactic have a significantly lower incidence of COVID-19. And again, India and Japan are just two of these examples. Now, Harold Pease writes that Attorney General Peterson in Nebraska found that peer-reviewed COVID studies treating patients with ivermectin reported positive outcomes, including shorter time to resolution of disease manifestations that were attributed to COVID-19. Greater reduction in inflammatory marker levels, shorter time to viral clearance, and lower mortality rates in patients who received ivermectin than in patients who received comparator drugs or placebo. The drug led to improvement of COVID outcomes when used in early treatment or as a prophylaxis. Now, he also noted that the few negative studies on the use of ivermectin as a COVID treatment were not peer-reviewed. And in fact, they excluded most available evidence, cherry-picked data within studies, misreported data, made unsupported assertions of adverse reactions to ivermectin, and had conclusions that did not follow from the evidence. In the case of the hostile treatment of hydroxychloroquine published in The Lancet, the statistics were flawed and the authors refused to provide analyzed data. Even its editor, Dr. Richard Horton, later admitted, after publication that the paper was a fabrication, a monumental fraud, and a shocking example of research misconduct in the middle of a global health emergency. Well, if that doesn't build confidence in the medical establishment, I don't know what could. So why the opposition by Big Pharma to two drugs that could already cure COVID? Well, Harold Pease says the answer is money. Even without ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, 99% will survive COVID. Vaccines would not be necessary. They don't work anyway. Else, why would one need boosters every 3 months? Look at all the industry profits already made. The truth is, COVID is a trillion-dollar industry. Are we smart enough to see the obvious? He says probably the best evidence for ivermectin as an effective cure for COVID is, however, Merck, the patent holder of ivermectin, who is not promoting it as a COVID cure. Why? Well, because ivermectin, a cheap 46-year-old drug, has long wore out its profit potential. Why not create a new drug, largely ivermectin, call it Molnupiravir? Up the price 100 times plus, market it as just discovered as a cure for COVID. The U.S. government has agreed to pay Merck about $1.2 billion for 1.7 million courses of its experimental COVID-19 treatment if it is proven to work in an ongoing large trial and authorized by regulators. Molnupiravir aims to stop COVID from progressing when given early in the course of the disease, just like ivermectin does right now. Isn't that something? Dr. Pease says, forward a copy of this column to your elected state leaders. Ask them to join Nebraska in restoring doctors' medical freedom to prescribe what they and you feel is best for you. Pretty good stuff. I like Dr. Pease, and I think this is a really timely article. And even without it, I have to say, I'm flabbergasted at how many people, you know, are looking for reasons not to believe, looking for reasons to reject the possibility that there could be anything to the use of either ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine. Now, I know it's anecdotal, but I've talked to three different people, none of whom know each other, who all have had very positive experiences with ivermectin. And I'm not talking, you know, they were eating horse paste or whatever. I'm sure there are those who have done it effectively and, you know, don't give themselves the whole tube like they're a 1,200-pound horse. But these were using ivermectin that was prescribed by, you know, a doctor. This was the pharmaceutical stuff. And to a person, they report that they started to have symptoms. I think all of them were tested and found to be positive for COVID-19. So they started on ivermectin right away, and this is the common thread between all of them. Within 24 hours, they absolutely were on the mend. Like 90% of their symptoms were gone, and they were improving from that point forward. And so I ask you, how is that a bad thing? And I know there are some who'll say, well, now, you know, Brian, people could have adverse reactions, you know. Some people could die from taking that. Yes. Good thing we can't say that about the vaccine, right? Oh, wait a minute. Let's look at what the VAERS report has to say about, you know, these vaccine injuries and so forth. And by the way, there's some very interesting evidence coming out about vaccine injuries. And look, I'm not trying to tell you you should be totally anti-vax. I'm saying the reality is vaccines, COVID and otherwise, can cause injury. That is just part of the natural laws that we live under. For some people, the reactions are going to be less than positive. I was looking at some numbers in a report yesterday. I didn't have a chance to really study this, you know, in great depth. But if what this report appears to show is true, roughly 5% of the batches of vaccine that went out are responsible for 90% or more of the vaccine injuries and adverse reactions that people have experienced in getting the jab. Isn't that interesting? And by the way, those five bad batches, or the five suspect batches, if you will, I'm sorry, I can't think of a diplomatic way to say this without it sounding like, well, you're spinning this hard. These were the most widely distributed batches. So it's a story I'll be keeping an eye on. I don't have enough to go on it at the moment, but wouldn't that be an interesting possibility? Look, the bottom line is this. If you feel that the vaccine is the best bet for you, for instance, if you're in a high-risk category, make the decision that's best for you. I'm not the one who can tell you this is what you have to do. I don't want to presume that kind of responsibility for your life and your health. By the same token, that's the attitude you and I should have towards everybody else who chooses differently than we do. Because some people are going to say, it's not for me. Respect that. But I don't know. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of hatred that's being pushed toward people who remain unvaccinated. I think that's an artificially generated bit of outrage. And I think it's coming from a place of emotion rather than a place of reason. But the sad thing is it's working. People are losing their jobs and people are paying a very high price for not being in compliance with a particular health directive that is being used as a one-size-fits-all solution. That isn't really that much of a solution, it turns out. Especially since you need boosters on the regular. Boy, that almost felt like a rant. Why do I say that? Because I just feel better. Thank you for letting me get that out there. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Hey, just want to give a quick shout out here to my newest sponsor, that is governyourincome.com. There's a link in the show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. In a nutshell, if I can just jump right to the chase, this is an opportunity for someone who really wants to have a truly independent income through day trading. Now, we're not talking day trading penny stocks or even trading the stock market itself. This is day trading on the foreign currency exchange, or Forex. And if you think about this, no matter what the markets do, so if the U.S. stock market were to tank tomorrow, the foreign exchange currency markets are still going to have to operate. There still has to be a way for that money to change hands between different foreign currencies, different foreign currency holders. Now, this is not something for everybody, but if you're a person who's very serious about your income and keeping it insulated from mandates and insulated from corporate dictates, and you want to be able to do it from anywhere that you have an internet signal, please click on the link, governyourincome.com, and just look at things. You can pay $10 to run a little demo of their proprietary software. They train you how to do the trading. But I'm going to emphasize again, it's not for everybody. But if you're the kind of person who can thrive and who knows how to crunch the numbers, you could do very, very well. Please check it out. So here's some good news. I thought we would end on kind of a positive note. The term insurrection is being used a lot. I find myself using it mockingly. Anytime something doesn't go my way, I describe it as an insurrection. Somebody messed up my order at the drive-thru window. This insurrection cannot go unpunished. And it's dramatic. It's like calling everything, you know, terrorism after 9/11. If I don't get my steak in the next 5 minutes, the terrorists will have won. It's the same kind of thing. It's the same principle. It's just you apply it to everything that inspires outrage and, you know, boom, you know, everything's an insurrection. But here's the good news. According to J. Michael Waller, a growing number of Americans are clearly rejecting the narrative that it was an insurrection on January 6th. Two polls are showing that very few Americans believe it was a coup either, or an insurrection. The numbers are declining. Here's what J. Michael Waller says. He says, Americans never bought House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's insurrection narrative about the January 6th violence at the Capitol. And the majority believe the incident was not as serious as portrayed, according to a new pair of polls. More Americans identify the mayhem as either a riot or protests rather than an insurrection, armed or otherwise, according to polls published in June and October. Now, the Center for Security Policy commissioned those polls with TIPP in May and September, asking the same respondents for multiple answers to identify precise public perceptions about the riot that occurred during the January 6th protest. As the Congressional January 6th committee began hearings in late September, the percentage of Americans who agreed with the insurrection narrative had declined since spring. In fact, more Americans described January 6th events as unlawful entry or vandalism rather than Pelosi's favored term of insurrection. By the way, I think it's worth noting, as far as I know, not a single person of the hundreds who were rounded up and some, most of them being held as political prisoners now in Washington, D.C., none have actually been charged with insurrection. Huh. It's kind of a curious oversight, don't you think? You'd think that would be at the top of the list if that's what they were engaged in. But it's not. Actually, J. Michael Waller says rejection of the insurrection narrative is the strongest among Republicans, independents, and people of color. And the poll results show no majority view as to what Americans call the events of January 6th. Now, back in June, 9% of Republicans and 13% of independents identified with the insurrection label, 5 and 13% with the armed insurrection term. But by October, those numbers had decreased. Democrats held the strongest view, with 18% choosing insurrection in June, 15% in October, and armed insurrection at 22 and 19%, respectively. And again, just out of curiosity, where did they get that armed insurrection? The only armed individuals were the police, one of whom, a Capitol police officer, shot to death an unarmed protester. With impunity. That's the only one that I can think of. Nobody else was armed. Blacks and Hispanics showed more skepticism about the insurrection narrative than whites. The June poll showed 11% of people of color agreed with the insurrection label, 9% with armed insurrection, but 4 months later, those numbers held steady at 10% and 9% respectively. And the term chosen most often by respondents to describe January 6th was domestic terrorism at 25% in June and 23% in October. Now, this was not the term of choice for Pelosi. The Justice Department has not charged any January 6th suspect with terrorism-related crimes, but the opinion is strong among the sizable minority that favors the description. Now, variations were small in both polls among race and sex, the sharpest differences being according to political affiliation. 34 and 33% of Democrats in both polls called January 6th domestic terrorism, compared to 14 and 11% of Republicans and 21 and 22% of independents. Fewer people of color than whites called it domestic terrorism in June. That would be 21% among blacks and Hispanics and 26% among whites, but practically matched in October, with 24 and 23% respectively. So I guess the bottom line here is most consider January 6th as less serious than the narrative alleges. That's good news. Okay, it's not because, well, political violence is actually acceptable as long as it's my side that's engaging in it. So please don't mistake what I'm saying here for, you know, defending people acting out in violent or destructive ways. But it never looked like an insurrection. That's just a political cuss word being thrown around by members of the political class who are also trying very hard to look like victims so that they can, you know, clamp down and acquire even more power over the citizenry. Who, I might add, is righteously ticked off at some of the things that we're being forced into by the political class. I wonder if they realize, you know, this is a pretty dangerous game they're playing. You start treating people like domestic terrorists, they may start acting like domestic terrorists. What was it that Bruce Banner used to say about, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry. Okay, don't treat me like a criminal. You wouldn't like me when I'm a criminal. Back to the article here. Respondents, when given a broad set of choices, overwhelmingly did not agree with the dominant narrative of insurrection or even domestic terrorism, even though those terms plus armed insurrection made up 3 of the 6 most popular responses. The number of respondents who were not sure about what to call January 6th That's 13% in June, 14% in October, was equal to and greater than those who actually called it an insurrection. Civil disobedience and insurrection got roughly equal responses in the poll, with more choosing civil disobedience in October, just outside the poll's margin of error. So, I mean, you had words that, less serious words describing January 6th included things like riot, protest, unlawful entry. They could also choose vandalism, civil disobedience, mob, trespassing, demonstration, rebellion, unrest, siege, looting, revolt, or petty theft. Now, J. Michael Waller says, look, these polls were designed to gauge with precision the public's opinion about the January 6th events by inviting up to three answers. And about 1,300 respondents in the June and October polls were asked in an online questionnaire which of the following words best describe the events of January 6th in Washington, D.C. Please select up to three. So a triple voting system was allowed to measure mood in a more nuanced way than single answers would provide. And for this reason, the total percentage of answers far exceeds 100%. So one can safely conclude significant overlap among responses. I guess the margin of error for these polls or cred interval is 2.8%. So I have a link to this in the show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. Look, I'm not saying you should agree with what the crowd did at the Capitol back on January 6th. But I'm also suggesting neither should you feel like you have to agree with what the politicians are saying happened, when clearly it appears that a portion of this has been exaggerated and blown out of proportion. I mean, they've succeeded in getting some of the video released, 14,000 hours of surveillance video. And it's very clear. The majority of people who walked into the U.S. Capitol did just that. Some of them being waved in by police officers, Capitol police officers, who opened up the barriers and let them come in and look around. You know what we're not hearing, though, is we're not hearing much about did the FBI have informants? Did they have assets in that crowd? And in fact, what role were they playing? I wonder why there's such a deafening silence on that matter.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.